Blog Talk Radio.
Joyce also was attempting to do something very, very modern indeed in technique. This was not altogether original, but he felt the techniques that had been used in the novels, say, of Dickens, Thackeray, and the rest of them, and even H.G. Wells, Arnold Bennett, were not sufficiently subtle to show what's really going on in the human mind. We say things in normal life, but we also think things. And Joyce had to develop a technique for showing what's going on in the mind on the pre-verbal level, before people actually speak. The most difficult interior monologue we shall meet is that of Stephen, the young poet, 22 years of age. His mother's just died, he's just come back from Paris, he doesn't know where he is, but he's essentially a poet and an intellectual, and a rather bumptious young man. Joyce had various reasons for going into exile, if we may call it that. Of course, in the first place, a very banal reason. You cannot write in Dublin. There's too much talk. Anybody who's tried to write a book in Dublin knows that the book can be spent in a couple of pub conversations. You don't want to write the book after that. You've done the job of being a bard and given out the words. There's nothing in Ulysses which is really intelligible unless you understand this Jesuit-educated background, this life in a small city, this resentment at church, at family, at nationalism, at the British Empire, and all these various factors which perhaps drove Joyce out of the British Isles to live in the continent of Europe, to become a European. Joyce did recognize that out there in Europe, as he put it, the modernistic movement was stirring. Joyce saw also that the Jew was the real protagonist of modern history. Joyce knew nothing of the Holocaust, of course, but he did recognize that Jew was the key figure, not the Christian, not the pagan, in modern life, and, of course, also in modern literature. Nora was uneducated, almost illiterate, direct, very Irish, very honest, and it seems to us, sexually, much more liberated than we normally think an Irish woman should be, especially at that period. And Molly, at the end of that book, is Nora. I think without this earthy, unintellectual Galway girl he married, he could not have got to the depth of the feminine soul. Although Nora herself said, Jim knows nothing about women. But Jung said, as far as the knowledge of women is concerned, you must have been inspired by the devil. Ulysses is about love. It's not the sloppy love of Barbara Cartland, it's the profounder love of men for men, men for the city, men for civilization, man and woman, biological, intellectual, but most of all this incredible love which is possible between a Jew and a young Irishman, the substitute father, if you like, the substitute son, but more than that, the necessity of the intellect represented by Joyce himself, by Stephen, and common sense, the body represented by Bloom, these coming together to form a symbiosis. And I think you have to end up by saying that Ulysses is really, despite the Jewish hero and the renegade secondary hero, Stephen, it is a Catholic testament in a curious way. It does present the importance of the city, the importance of the male community, and more than anything, the desperate importance of transmuting ordinary experience into what he called epiphanies, you know, views of the truth, the shining truth coming out of ordinary things. That's what art is to Joyce, but not to many other writers. With those of us who know Joyce, when we sit down to write a novel, as I do, I feel desperate. I feel I cannot match Ulysses. I must do what I can.
And welcome in our craft or sullen art. I am Richard Weissman, your host, coming tonight from the great Midwest, the small city of Bismarck, North Dakota, and we are celebrating an early celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses in honor of Doomsday. So Doomsday does not fall on my one of our show nights. Instead, we're doing an early celebration on the 9th instead of when it should be celebrated on the 16th. And we've got some people that are joining us. Let me bring them on one by one. Seven-one-five, you're on the air.
Hey, Richard, it's Pam. How's it going?
Hi, Pam. Good, good. So let me bring our other people on, and then let's talk some Ulysses.
Awesome. Sounds fun.
585. I'm thinking this is Laurent.
Good evening, Richard. How are you?
Good. How are you feeling?
Well, like I said on the chat, you take a 3-hour nap and you wake up and the world looks a little different. You know, I got to say, though, that the a discussion of Ulysses in poetry combined with Bismarck in South Dakota, very fitting. Very fitting.
Yeah, well, travel is back, so I'm here. Let me bring on one other caller. 646, you're on the air. Who's there?
Hi, this is Mark from Cleveland.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
It's true. It's been a while. Hi, Lauren. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Mark. Pleasure.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Mark. Glad you could be here.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, so unfortunately my co-host Neutron came down with COVID, but she I'm sure is going to be joining us in 2 weeks for our next one. But I know she is a huge Anthony Burgess fan, so I picked this clip in her honor, and this is him talking James Joyce and Ulysses, of course. And I do think that there is a lineage that Joyce influenced an entire generation of writers that came after him, as well as his contemporaries, obviously. But this kind of lineage, and most obviously, like Samuel Beckett was his secretary when he was kind of going blind and writing Finnegan's Wake. And Anthony Burgess is another one. You can really see that Joycean influence on language in A Clockwork Orange, where Burgess kind of creates his own language, just like Joyce did in Finnegan's Wake, and a little bit did in Ulysses, like in the Circe episode. So I thought it was a nice way to start our Joyce celebration. And I've got to be a little bit creative because I do this every year, so I didn't want to use the same clip as last year. But let's go around the room. So, Laurent, what did you think of that clip?
I thought it was a brilliant bit of audio, quite frankly. I think Burgess realizes that Joyce gave a newfound freedom to most writers concerning the way they express themselves and how they address truths. That was very, very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And Pam, did you have a chance to hear the clip?
I did, yes. And you can definitely tell he was a big influence in Burgess's thinking. And I like how he basically said, I'm probably paraphrasing here, you know, that that to keep in mind that, you know, to keep in mind that it's basically like a free thought verses within the book, you know, that it's basically a lot of nonsense. And then the idea that one should never try to be exactly like Joyce, you know, so just a really excellent choice for an intro.
Thanks, Pam. And Mark, did you have a chance to hear it?
I actually heard one sentence from it where Lucas that's all I, Burgess said he couldn't match Joyce ever, but he had to try his best. And I recall my first encounter with Joyce, really, you know, because of, you know, big name and just reading through it. But I just remember how amazed I was. I remember reading the Sirens episode, you know, the barmaids in an Irish bar, and the incredible language, just the firm grounding in reality and the amazing language. And so I just sympathize with Bruges. It's like nothing else, really, the reading spirits.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, you know, what I really like about Joyce is that he's such an innovator. And in the beginning, when you first are introduced to him, it's, you know, there's this kind of like formidability regarding his work, and this, you know, it's just almost like larger than life reverence. But when you get beyond that and you just kind of have fun reading it, it really is fun. And he's writing comedy. There's so many funny parts that the joy really does kind of come through, and that's what keeps me reading him year after year. So now I know that we've got a lot of poetry, and I know that people have to go to bed and stuff. People have to wake up tomorrow and go to work and get early night sleep. So let me – now, Pam, are you okay with being my co-host and putting poems up?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do that.
Thanks so much.
Yep.
So let me just ask the question – Laurent, would it be helpful if you were to read your poem, just in case you wanted to bow out gracefully?
Well, I mean, any time is fine. I don't have to read it immediately, but I'll yield to whatever you wish to do.
Okay, and then let me ask the same question, Mark. Do you have to read and run?
No, I can stay for a bit.
Okay.
Anyway, so I'm in no particular hurry, is what I'm saying. I could wait a half hour.
Yeah.
Okay.
So with that, I will turn it over to you, Pam. The floor is yours.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Up first, we have The Overnight Staff by Ken Smith. And Laurent, will you give that a read for us, please?
Certainly. The Overnight Staff. It was raining steady, 9:30 p.m., my regular time to bike into work. I unlocked the bike from the outside railing, attached the flashing nightlight, and started pedaling fiercely so as not to arrive soaking wet. At the marina front dock in the dark, slanting rain, through the gleaming white boat, I informed the boat owner I was the Overnight Staff. He answered yes in a kind of Spanish accent. He was to leave his 55-foot castle on the water, moored there until morning. He sat down in one of the wicker chairs out front, so I joined him. He looked early 40s and had on a white boater's cap with the sides turned up and snapped, with a dark goatee, blonde. Said he'd purchased a 3-tier motor yacht used, and was driving it to Toronto on Lake Ontario, where he was going to captain and charter his vessel to groups of 20 tourists at $2,000 per tour, 3 tourists per day. He grinned through his goatee and said he'd make $1 million by the end of the summer season. He then winked and added, "Not bad for a sewage tradesman emigrated from Colombia, eh?" I slowly nodded in respect and surprise. He then boarded, said he'd ordered takeout delivery, and to let him know when it arrived. There was a knock on the marina office door. I woke suddenly, having dozed off for what seemed only minutes. rising, half asleep from the chair. I saw he was lying in bed. I got up and went to the door with the landlady wanting her toilet plunger back. In the dusky room, my alarm clock read 9 p.m. I dressed quickly, closed the book of Spanish translation open on my computer desk, and donned my white voter's cap with the sides turned up and snapped. Then jogged down the stairs. It was raining steady. I unlocked my bike from the outside railing and attached the flashing nightlight. I would have to pedal fiercely so as not to arrive soaking wet. End poem.
Great read, Laurent. Yeah, and that was to the prompt, every life is in many ways, day after day, I'm sorry, every life is in many days, day after day. We walk through ourselves, meeting robbers, ghosts, giants, old men, young men, wives, widows, brothers-in-law, but always meeting ourselves. And boy, what a right. In the dusky room, my alarm clock read 9 p.m. I dressed quickly, closed the book of Spanish translation, opened on my computer desk, and donned my white voter's cap with the sides turned up and snapped. And it goes on. I love that I would have to pedal fiercely so as not to arrive soaking wet. That Twilight Zone ending where he riffs quite expertly off the prompt. We walk through ourselves, very surreal, and truly a modernist piece of prose poetry, which, of course, is how Joyce himself wrote. It kind of reminded me of the end of Joyce's short story, The Dead, from Dubliners. I thought it was just a great piece and a nice way to open our evening of celebration of Joyce. And, Pam, what did you think?
Yeah, I really liked how there was a kind of like dreamlike quality to this, and yet at the same time, there were things that were so very raw and real about it. And I really liked the sense of humor in he then winked and added, "Not bad for a sewage tradesman emigrated from Colombia, eh?" I probably said that more like a Canadian than a Colombian, but that's all right. It's a really intriguing story about the whole idea of almost being like it almost feels like he was awoken from a dream. And I like the idea of I would have to pedal fiercely so as not to arrive soaking wet, which is a great line of irony. You know, because basically, as we all know, there's just no way to avoid getting soaking wet once it's raining. So, excellent write and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment, Pam. And Mark, your thoughts?
Yeah, it was very much in the spirit of Joyce, I'd say, in Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, too. You know, just another kind of a mix of dream and existence. It seems like I got the impression that the whole thing with the marina, with Insurance and it was a dream based on him, the sewage salesman, Spanish, and then he wakes up, he's in bed, and he has his Spanish book and his toilet plunger. It's kind of his. So I'm not even sure what's going on. It's a mix of kind of dream state and reality. Maybe that's his job. Maybe it's a dream. And he wakes up, and it's interesting. It's like Finnegan's Wake, the book starts where the first paragraph's the same as the last one. So this is kind of a cyclic journey for something that to me might be a dream. I guess it'll go on forever, just like Finnegan's Wake is cyclic, and anyway, they're very much in the spirit of it. It's very well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Great insights, yeah. And Laurent, as reader, I'll give you final word.
I really have to agree with Mark. The piece begins where it finishes, or vice versa, finishes where it began. And in between, we do have that greed, that dream state. I was initially a little puzzled by the next to last stanza, where his alarm clock reads 9 p.m., yet it started at 9:30, and then I realized that Mark was correct, and that it had to be a dream state. And within that dream, he presents us in stanzas 3 and 4 with what seems to be a humble individual who had managed to put together the means to success, almost as if when he says, where is it? I slowly nodded in respect and surprise, as if to say, I never would have thought it by looking at this individual that he had managed to concoct this scheme. But the scheme is within the dream, and reality lies on the outside of that. Excellent piece.
Absolutely. Great comments. And with that, I am turning it back to you, Pam, for our next one.
All right. Up next, we have Travel Through the Days to Meet Self by S. Sharp. And Mark, will you give that a read for us, please?
Travel Through the Days to Meet Self. Travel through the days to meet oneself. Walk through self. To steal oxygen from the mouth of the sun. Go to the turnstiles of sensibility. Hide from the giants of certain doubts invading the mind of history and man. Mentor the shipwreck of newly crowned manhood. Light the passion and the wives of eternity. Console midnight with the weeping willow of widows of sanity. Stand in awe of the blood connection of brothers. Meander through moral caverns of shadow and light coalescing. As dreams and failure walk hand in hand down the aisle. Hang pictures as remedies on the transparent walls of depression. Launch reverie to supersede temporary mortality. Seek reflection in self-made pools of murkiness. Drown oneself in the arid dust with desert fingers. On dust of limbs, carry life like pollen. Onto the progeny of the Mesarian stars. Smile upon the children of generations destined for all the faces of the shadow moon.
Great read, Mark. Thank you so much. Pam, if we can start with you, what do you think?
Absolutely. I like the idea that it comes out in the title alone, in the idea of a journey of self-discovery. Hide from the giants of certain doubt invading the mind of history and man. Mentor the shipwreck of newly crowned manhood. They're really, you know, I like that this starts with a point of youth, almost like at a point of, you know, going through puberty and, you know, going through becoming a man physically and emotionally. And as dreams and failures walk hand in hand down the aisles, having pictures as remedies from the transparent walls of depression. There's really, you could just definitely see the emotional struggles within this as somebody takes a journey in their own mind. And I like the phrase, desert existence on gusts of wind carry life like pollen. You know, we don't often think about how much life there truly exists within the desert. So beautifully written and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment, Pam. Yeah, I too really love this brevity. For me, I actually did multiple reads as the images and concepts were quite layered. It seemed a truly artful, in the best sense of the word, construction, and I especially liked to steal oxygen from the mouth of the sun and meandering through caverns of shadows and light coalescing. Dreams and failure walk hand in hand down the aisle, hang pictures as remedies on the walls of sadness, launch reverie to supersede this temporary mortality, see reflections of consciousness in self-made ponds of confusion, drown oneself in the arid dust of existence, gusts of wind, manage all the phases of the shadow moon. Wow, just, you know, lots of archetypal energy and just brimming with deep dives into the unconscious and Jungian collective unconscious. It's a very deep piece. And Laurent, your idea.
Well, I was going to begin my quote with hang pictures as remedies, but you did a very good job of grabbing that beautifully written piece of this poem. I like the way Scott details the days point by point, the many mundane and transcendental moments and actions of our lives, all in response to the many selves that inhabit him. And, I think by extension, all men and women who drown themselves in the arid dust of this desert existence. So it's so beautifully written.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Mark, as reader, I'll give you final word.
Sure. Yeah, but you got it with archetypal, one aspect of it anyway. Picture this is like a walk through existence, a Joycean type walk, looking at all the relationships, all the, archetypes of humanity that you feel miss from, the blood connection of brothers, the giants of certain doubt, through moral pay caverns of shadow and light coalescing. That's like the pilgrimage traversal over human experience, and the poetry is, very strong, beautiful lines. Walk through stealth, steal oxygen from the mouth of the sun, go through the turnstiles of sensibility. Those are beautiful images just to express no kind of outreach and journey, kind of spiritual journey. It's very much of a spirit of beautiful.
Absolutely. Great comment. And with that, Pam, I am turning us back to you.
All right. Let me see here. All right. Up next, we have Bookworms by W.P. McLeod 1. And Richard, will you give that a read for us, please?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is, and there's so many extraordinary pieces tonight. So this one is called Bookworms by W.P. McLeod 1, and it goes like this. Amid the ink drinkers and the leaf eaters, the silver white larvae speckle, wriggle, and squirm, devouring the dry papyrus and binding paste, albino scorpions racing, burrowing cover to cover, to the spine-tingling denouement when friends lift mugs in alehouses and reflect on age spots and the purple bruise of death as the pages riddle into snowflakes of black dust and the candle soot. Letters wash in rivulets of starless dark, flowing to the violet sea of soundless violence and voiceless violence, swelling in waves of the aspen for the earless lobsters clawing the sandy bottoms of the wordless deep. End of poem. And Laurent, if we can start comments off of you.
This is a wonderful poem, Bookworms. To use insects, variety of kinds, calling them ink drinkers and leaf eaters, and have them devour the dry papyrus and binding paste, begin to consume the words that fascinate us in books, borrowing cover to cover to the spine-tingling denouement when friends lift mugs in the alehouses and reflect on age spots. He begins to introduce scenery, thoughts from books as they are devoured, and you really begin to see how well he accomplished answering the quote of he wanted to cry quietly, but not for himself, for the words so beautiful and sad, like music. I love the approach that he took, the disintegration of words, the physical words, not necessarily the thoughts, but by extension, the thoughts, certainly. And I love the way he uses earless lobsters clawing the sandy bottom of the wordless deep. Just, boy, this is a beautiful piece.
Absolutely, yeah. I too, really love this one. I just thought it was so clever. It was so Joycean. He draws us in with this vivid word painting right from the start. Worms, a wonderful metaphor for impermanence and death. And what I didn't actually get on the first go-round, but I got when I was reading it just now, was that it actually could be a reference in Finnegan's Wake, earwigs, which are basically like worms. So that is a whole other level that I didn't even catch the first time. So there's so much in actually quite a brief number of words that's baked into this one. Just another fabulous write, and it's going to be one heck of a contest to try and judge. And Mark, your thoughts?
No, you guys have kind of said it all. My own feelings about this. It's beautiful, powerful poetry. It's, you know, it's about death in the end. The books as art is our attempt to. It's ironic. I mean, the prompt is saying the words are so beautiful. The poem itself, off the prompts, about how the words get dismantled and broken apart, and they flow into the wordless deep at the end. It's kind of sad in that way, but it's so powerful that you just—it's refreshing in a way. But just kind of art and you know, the entropy of the universe, that kind of thing, everything headed. And the language is incredibly beautiful, but it's awash in with the starless dark, pulling to the violet sea of soundless violence. The whole poem is an incredible language.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Pam, I'll give you final word.
Yeah, I have to agree with all of you. This is a stunning write. It's got powerful imagery. Definitely is not going to be an easy contest for you to judge, Richard. I love the title Bookworms, and how, you know, it gives me the impression of being up late at night and reading a book, and the way your eyes begin, the words begin to blur in front of your eyes. But I like that it also is that metaphor for a celebration of life, with the lift mugs and ale houses and reflect on age spots and the purple bruise of death as the pages riddle into snowflakes of black dust and the candle suit letters wash in rivulets of starless dark. That is just, there's something very profound about those lines, and the idea of that darkness that kind of just envelopes the mind. And beautifully written and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. And with that, I am going to turn it back to you for our next piece.
All right. Up next, we have The Inner Organs of Beasts and Fowls by Jason John Morgan. And it goes like this. Of all awful to fall off the fork into the mouth of Leopold Bloom, mutton kidneys from the grill kissed with a hiss of fire and tasting faintly of piss were his favorite. All of the inner organs, obese and foul, were eaten by Bloom with relish. Now, was that A, cooked and pickled condiment, B, with great enjoyment, C, both? Whatever choice, Joyce is cackling in his grave at our confusion. End poem.
Great read, Pam. And Mark, if we could start with you, what do you think?
I remember that scene from Ulysses, how Bloom liked all the strange meats, the organ meats, and this keying off of it. And it's, this poem is really, it's a beautifully written poem, and nice description, language very vivid, getting into the subject of this condiment meat that tastes like urine that the Bloom loved the taste of. But it's he's pointing out that this novel is what you said earlier, Richard. It's a huge human comedy, if it's nothing else. Joyce is the comedian. This is his act, writing about this, and he poses kind of Bloom into this weird food, and this food is kind of nourishment, but also, you know, excrement mixed together, and that's life, you know. That's the joke I see in it, and Joyce probably meant that, and a lot more. It makes a very good point, this one, about what his novel's up to.
Absolutely, yeah, excellent point. And, I love that... Jason John Morgan tackled the prompt that brings us to episode 4, Calypso, and introduces us, you know, 4 episodes in, finally introduces us to the main character, which is quite a thing to do in a novel. I don't know that many contemporary novelists would have that kind of courage to introduce their main character, you know, that far into the novel. But there he is. And I thought he did a wonderful job with this brevity. I like how he emphasized relish and then asked the question, now is that A, cooked and pickled condiment, B, with great enjoyment, or C, both? And he accurately showcases Joyce's love of the double entendre and his valuing good ambiguity and love of wordplay and just the fun of writing, the fun of literature. And, just a great brevity. And, Laurent, your thoughts?
The prompt is probably one of my favorite bits from the book that I remember. How can you not? To establish a character, one can use a lot of literary devices, but the implication of the grilled mutton kidneys, which gave to his palate a fine tang of faintly scented urine, stands out because he treats it as if it was a bottle of wine. And here we have urine. And we have urine. We drown in urine as a child. We drown in urine as an old man. I just thought it was a lovely bit of, it's not laughter. It's not a joke. But when he says, now is that a cooked and pickled condiment? or with great enjoyment, or both, and then leads us into Joyce cackling at our confusion, because he allows us to turn over the spit the same way that the inner organs of beasts and fowls turn over the spit and become done with time. So do we too become done as we read and kind of marinate in his words. It's an excellent piece.
Nicely done there, Laurent. And Pam, your thoughts?
I really enjoyed this one. I enjoyed how, as you said, he highlighted the main character and, Joyce's way of playing with words and the humor within this. It's fun. It's clever. It's great wordplay. And I like that ending. Joyce is cackling in his grave at our confusion. You know, I can just imagine that. So, excellent write.
Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah, I knew this was going to be a fun night. I'm sitting here smiling. And with that, let's move on to our next one.
All right. And Laurent, I put your poem up. Go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
All right. This is called Cheap at the Price. I seek an extension to propagate myself, desirous of touch in the anointed presence of an august holy roller who promises paradise and delivers an actual whiff of the place. Mary, Mary, quite contrary, garden bound with no bark in her bite, drooling giggles from a mouthful of mirth, her polymorphous phrasing of expiation pouring forth row by verbal row, all things planted in stages. Accusatory fingers wag, an iron cerebellum potshots wildly, ringing the bell at the fair. It's all cooked and ready to swallow. Forgiveness on a stick. Street food that tempts the truth. But don't drink the water, whispers the sotto voce in my ear, as truth folds in on itself. Spackled fat and running juices down my chin. It's cheap divinity at my fingertips that allows a return to Eden, to correct mistakes made. Nirvana was never so close, remaining unreachable in its impending rescue from mundanity of thought and cheap kisses for sale I am so ready to buy. Pennies on a dead man's eyes seems to be the least cost of it. A spade's full of dirt clattering onto my closed casket is the last sound I'll never hear. Cheap at the price. End poem.
Wow. Wonderful read there, Laurent. Mark, if we could open up with you.
Now, this is a pretty deeply written, deeply thought out poem. But what I got from it was, again, the Joycean theme of wandering through existence. In this case, it seems at least in some sort of existential street fair, just kind of wandering around, listening to the holy roller, the promises, the cooking, the metaphor, the buying something to eat and mixing that with a kind of sacrament, forgiveness on the stick, just this kind of interplay of kind of a street existence and a existential experience is what I got out of it. It was beautiful. This is life. In the end, it's like this is life, this mix of the incoherent promises of spirituality, perhaps, and the actual pleasures and details of existence, and the price you pay is death, cheap at the price. You know, it's the pennies on the Dead Man High closed casket. It finishes with death, but cheap at the price. The whole experience of life, all aspects of it. Beautiful poem.
Thank you, my friend.
Excellent comment there, Mark. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is wonderful. As always, you've got strong imagery and metaphors. I like that on the surface, this makes you think of cooking and traveling. Like for me, it does. Like the idea of like that one show, Strange Foods from Around the World, where the guy travels all over and tries all these weird foods. But, you know, you see all the ideas of the different ideas of, you know, the goodness and the ugliness being offered up in life. Like, you know, some of it that we take in is good for us, and some of it, you know, is definitely questionable. I did really particularly was drawn to the Mary, Mary, quite contrary, garden bound with no bark in her bite, drooling giggles from a mouthful of mirth. I love the use of the word polymorphous, which, of course, you know, I had to look up. But, you know, that and there was another word that I had to look up, which is always cool to me because I like learning from poetry. I like that you get visceral with the imagery with speckled fat and running juices down my chin. It's cheap divinity at my fingertips that allows a return to Eden to correct mistakes made. And, you know, that I think to me there's that idea that we don't have to overly pay for the sins that we commit, that there's a much easier way out, you know, than, I shouldn't say easier, but that maybe we make it too hard on ourselves to forgive ourselves. So just a really strong right here, Laurent, and very well done.
Thank you, Pam.
Absolutely. Great comment there, Pam. You know, of course, your writing is always very deep, Laurent, and very layered. When Pam, and I caught it actually when you were reading it, the Mary, Mary, quite contrary, because Joyce, throughout Ulysses, one of his big kind of themes is he's using music, Irish folk music, and so I did catch that the second time around, that you're bringing us into a nursery rhyme, and it makes it even more surreal. I thought it was an incredibly surreal glimpse into the afterlife, and it rang quite true to my intuition and my inner ear. It was Joycean with a touch of Dante thrown in for good measure, and I thought that was especially appropriate because although Joyce never overtly nods to Dante, his protege Beckett named Dante as one of his biggest influences. And so I thought it was incredibly appropriate. And, of course, death and the afterlife is a big part of Ulysses because of his Stephen's remembrances of his mother. So I thought you did a wonderful job with this prom. Excellent work.
Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. And with that, Pam, I think I see that you put up the next one.
Yes. Yes. Mark, your poem is up. Go ahead and give it a read for us.
I read all the other. I haven't read that one. I've read all the others. I didn't read that one in a while. I'll give it a shot. All right.
Okay.
Bitter mystery. Lift up your head and love anyway. Although it always goes away, love's bitter mystery, you say. Grunk and Fergus in a pose, while Yates' effluvia overflows and shapes into a mystic rose. Till Joyce's mother sheds her tears, and Joyce records her thwarted fears. Her spirit dutifully appears. His mother hung there, fun in space. It seems he barely knew her face. His words had such a burning grace. I know he knew his selfishness and what he drew in words. He had to carry through. I'll never be like that in thought or mood or act. I've never sought to be something that I'm not. Which means I lean toward apathy and, hey, that's what I like to be, an expiator, and that is me. But expiation, well, I'll do it. There's no enemy, that's the evil. There's subtle forging, that's the devil. So bitter mystery, I don't know. In fairy tales, it's just not so. Love is all the lovers know. It's the fact love can't protect. Weighed too hard, it will neglect, and therefore must be circumspect. And delegate to monsters loathing, or better, fairies more soothing. All ruled by death. A silly nothing. The drunken wagoner will wait, with horses standing at the gate. It's the death of anyone that I hate. End of quote.
Great read, Mark. And Laurence, if we can start with you.
Certainly. The so bitter mystery, I don't know. In fairy tales, it's just not so. Love is all the lovers know. It's a fact love can't protect. Weighed too hard, it will neglect, and therefore must be circumspect. These, to me, about love and why it remains to this day so mysterious, so talked about, so misinterpreted, so varied. And it's something that can be weighed in a thousand different ways. Although he says quite rightly, weighed too hard, it will neglect, and therefore must be circumspect. It's almost an unconscious pulling back from total commitment, but complete love, neglecting any negative aspects of what's going on. I really like this poem because in the first stanza, lift up your head, love anyway, although it always goes away. Love's bitter mystery, they say. It's an absolute fact. Although that is a quotation and not your words, you back it up with that second stanza, drunken Ferguson opposed while Yeats' effluvia overflows and shapes into a mystic rose. I really like this piece. I'm probably not analyzing it all that well. A lot of brain fog going on, but it's very well spun, very well written.
Thanks, Lauren.
I thought actually that was a really insightful comment, really well done. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm glad you could call in to read this, and I'm glad you were inspired. I really enjoy the three-line rhyming poem. It has a nice flow to it. I really like this all the way through, and it's thought-provoking, and, you know, I like that it touches on, to me, the general theme that I got from it was the idea how we misjudge who the enemy really is, or we misjudge, you know, what, as it says, you know, what evil truly is, what expiation, well, I'll drivel, there's no enemy, that's the evil, there's subtle thwarting, that's the devil. You know, the idea that, you know, what we think of as evil is maybe just thwarting, and I like the use of that word too, and also the use of the word circumspect. It's the fact that love can't protect, weighed too hard, it will neglect, and therefore must circumspect. I feel like within those lines is that thought that we oftentimes expect far too much from love. And maybe it goes the other way, too. Maybe it's like a two-sided coin. We expect too much from evil, and we expect too much from love, and we shouldn't be doing either. But really a wonderful rite with strong imagery and thought-provoking lines. So very well done, Mark.
Thanks, Pam.
Absolutely, Pam. Great comment. Yeah, you know, it's funny, the second go-round when you read it live made me think of David Foster Wallace, the quote, "Every love story is a ghost story," and just hit me that way. But I'll stick with my original comment, which is that I thought it was an incredibly strong lyrical offering. And having you read it, the lyricism really came to life. And the inspiration by the death of Daedalus's, and in fact, Joyce's mother, you truly captured the pathos, the mystery, and that stubborn, artistic, inquisitive mind refusing to kneel at her deathbed, the awfulness of dying in death itself. So I just thought you did a wonderful job with the prompt.
Well, thanks, guys. Wonderful comments. I mean, really, thank you.
Absolutely. And with that, Pam, I'm turning it back to you for our next one.
All right. Up next, we have Insight by Stelina. And we have a SoundCloud for that. So whenever you're ready, Richard.
Yep, I got it.
Look, and yet you do not see what is really true. So shut your eyes, and all will be revealed to you. Can you feel the love shining in your loved one's eyes, and the soft, moist welcome on their lips? The sun on your face on a summer's morn, or the cool, beckoning breeze of the ocean, the fragrance of bluebell in a carpeted wood, and the chorus of birdsong in dawn's fresh hue, the laughter of a child as they run into your arms, and the piano music lilting from an open window. Can you feel the sorrow of a loved one's loss, and the winds of war that blow so bleak, the sigh of a woman without arms to hold her, and the deafening silence of loneliness, night cries of a child abused and neglected, or the desperate plea of a homeless man, self-hatred as someone looks in the mirror, or the painful rage in someone's heart. Or to clearly see all and become truly wise, it is empathy and love which will open your eyes.
What a beautiful SoundCloud, not just the poetry, but the whole production, I thought, as well. And Mark, your thoughts?
I just, it was an amazing poem, and it was totally, totally brought to life by the SoundCloud. And the music was really nicely done, but her voice, it was perfect for the poem and so compelling. Just her read was just picking up on the emotion and that beautifully written poem and just going through it. I mean, you felt it all. The sun on your face on the summer's moon, you know, with the cool beckoning breeze of the ocean. As she read it, she just led you through it, and her voice and her words made them emotion happen. I was just kind of a little bit mesmerized by this one. It was really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Great comment. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, what a remarkable piece this is. Good luck. Good luck with your judging, my friend. To understand what one sees, comprehension bringing love, to see from deep inside where the eyes, the external eyes, are of no avail, but inner sight opens the inner mind, and one then sees all, certainly in respect to the individual. This poem has a lot to say. I like the emphasis on empathy, because if you can't empathize, there's no way you're going to identify with half the things you see in the world, and you can be cold and calculating and cruel, but to truly understand, then I think that brings love, because we are all of us failed humans in one respect or another. None of us is perfect. So I think the emotions expressed in this were absolutely excellent and really a basic truth. And I like poems that manage to take a truth and elaborate on it successfully the way that this one does, and it's a perfect response to the prompt, shut your eyes and see.
Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah, I too thought this was a heartfelt call to empathy and love in the face of the ills, as outlined in that penultimate stanza. Can you feel the sorrow of a loved one's loss and the winds of war that blow so bleak? Sigh of a woman without arms to hold her, and the deafening silence of loneliness, night cries of a child abused and neglected, or the desperate plea of a homeless man, self-hatred of someone looked in the mirror, or the painful rage in someone's heart. And oh my goodness, that SoundCloud really drove it home and brought it all to life. It's just amazing, the whole thing. And Pam, what do you think?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. And, you know, the background music can really add a nice touch to an already a beautiful poem. I really do like that this, you know, is about, you know, learning to find that empathy, learning to, you know, care about other people and not just yourself. I like how she did spelled insight on the instead of as one word to separate in and sight. I feel like there adds a kind of a nice, change of the original thought of the word. I like, can you feel the sorrow of a loved one's loss and the winds of her war that blow so bleak, the sigh of a woman without arms to hold her and the deafening silence of loneliness. The deafening silence of loneliness. You know, I think there's nothing that's louder than when you realize that, like, how truly hurt and neglected people are throughout the world, and beautifully written and very well done.
Excellent comment, Pam. Okay, and with that, let's move on to our next one.
All right. Up next, I have your poem. Oh, that's not your poem. Okay. I meant to have your poem up, but I think my screen jumped and I clicked the wrong one. So let's try this again. All right. There we go. There's your poem, Richard.
Okay. So, once upon a time, I wrote 18 poems for the 18 episodes. And this is episode 5, Lotus Eaters, which I kind of felt like was appropriate for the world that we're in now, which is just riddled with addiction and struggling, people struggling with addiction. So episode 5, Lotus Eaters, by Laurie's along Sir John Rogerson's quay, Mr. Bloom walks soberly past Windmill Lane around 10 a.m. Take of this, Selma, bearing fruit and sleep, lest he wait outside pub to bring Da home. Sleep 6 months of 12, too hot to quarrel mid equatorial isle, lethargy. Mystery of Henry Flower blooms in idleness. Hothouse and botanic gardens. Wilted water lilies. Too tired to tropical sleeping sickness. With nine circled air. Still silk slash rich stockings white. Lazing pool. Swirl of liquor along wide-leaved flowers of St. Patrick's black hop froth. Priest rinses wine blood from jeweled chalice, then swallow corpus down while Buddha blazes right side, preferring cold worship peace of China White. Blind faithful sleep near confession box. Safe in the arms his kingdom comes, lulls all pain, though iron nails ran through. I-N-R-I. Wake again, this time next year. Bloom at the chemist. Laudanum, sleeping draw, paregoric poppy syrup for bad cough, songs, warning labels, relaxative, bathe now, Narcissus, the clean trough of water, cool enamel, dental tepid, this is my body, peace, and saw the dark tangled curls of his bush, round limp father of thousands, a languid floating flower. End of poem.
Bravo there, Richard. Wonderful read. And as always, just impressive use of imagery and metaphors. And Laurent, let's start with your thoughts on Richard's poem.
Be happy to, although much to my surprise, I find that I hadn't read this beforehand and made a comment. So I'm going to jump into this. But what strikes me right off the bat is that third stanza. Sleep 6 months of 12, too hot to quarrel, mid-equatorial isle, lethargy, mystery of Henry Flower blooms in idleness. Hothouse in botanic gardens, wilted water lilies too tired from sleeping sickness, mists nine circled air, still silk flash, rich stockings, white. There is in this the essence, I think, of Bloom, who, if I'm not mistaken, used the pseudonym Henry Flower in a secret romantic correspondence with, I forget her name, but with that lazy pooling swirl of liquor, and the priest rinses wine in jeweled chalice and swallow corpus down, we really find the essence of Ulysses' poetics within the you grab so many references that not only inspire somebody who doesn't know Ulysses, but those who do can't help be impressed by what you've done. This is not the kind of comment that I would normally just want to deliver off the cuff. Your poem is layered and is deep, and it deserves much more, but it's what I have right now, and I am in deep admiration.
Well said there,
Lauren.
Thanks
so much, Laurent.
And, I have to agree with you on one of the points that you made is, because I've never actually read Ulysses myself. I should at some point. But I still appreciate this poem very much, and it is. It's one of those poems that, there's probably wonderful, juicy little tidbits that anybody who has read and knows Ulysses enjoys, and yet it's a poem that anyone can really dig into. I like being able to read your AN and because I would have automatically thought like lotus eaters were people who ate the insects, But the fact that learning in your AN that it's a narcotic that lulled the inhabitants into sleep in peaceful apathy, really, I can see why you said before reading this poem that is a great reflection on today's society and the lack of empathy that we often have. I really like the imagery and lazy pooling swirl of liquor along widely leavened flowers of St. Patrick black hopped froth. Now, even I who haven't read Ulysses can appreciate that with Joyce being an Irish writer and you mentioning St. Patrick's black hopped froth was a great little nod towards him. And, blind, faithful, asleep near confession box, safe in the arms, his kingdom comes. And wake again this time next year. You feel like there's definitely this idea of people who are sleeping through problems that need to be solved. So just an excellent write here, Richard, and very well done.
Thanks so much, Pam. Okay, and with that, we are ready for our next one.
All right. Up next, we have Changes by Ernest, and it goes like this. We always find attractive to look at the things we've done in our lives and see the way we like to live, to think, to feel, and how we are relating to the rest. It's comfortable to follow the old path that we are used to walk on every time, repeat the things we did and go along continuing the way that we have lived. To make adjustments to the course we took is always difficult because there is significant resistance and we fight with everything that changes our lives. Another wish that all of us possess is to obtain a better life for us and those we love, which shows that every time improving means to change what we are doing. End poem.
Nicely read there, Pam. Yeah, to make adjustments to the course we took is always difficult because there is significant resistance and we fight with everything that changes our lives. Awakening from the nightmare of history is not such an easy task as our poet rightly points out. Resistance to change, indeed, very difficult. Perhaps possible for the individual, and in my opinion, for society, maybe not so much. I thought it was excellent, an excellent response to the prompt, which was, history, Stephen said, is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. And Laurent, your thoughts on it?
I think it's a case of the devil we know. which is the one we don't, we can be comfortable with a lot of things that aren't perfect, but manage to let us make those incremental steps. And we can go back and think about those steps. And you know, it's comfortable to follow the old path that we're used to walk on every time, repeat the things that we did and go along continuing the way that we have lived. And then to make a change, a sea change especially, takes a lot of guts. Or something that has happened in your life that forces us in that direction. But if we simply trust ourselves, I think, and use love as the most important indicator, we can improve. But improving means to change what we're doing, as he says in the last line. And that sure as hell, it's hard. And if you've made a lot of bad decisions, then indeed, history is a nightmare. Excellent piece.
Absolutely. Great insight. And Pam, as reader, I'll give you final words.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. For a free verse poem, it had a nice flow to it. I like the observations that both you and Lawrence made. It is difficult. Even when things aren't going well, sometimes we want to stick with what we know rather than make a change. But as Lawrence says, you know, we have to learn to trust our instincts. I really like it's comfortable to follow the old path that we are used to and walk on every time. And that, as you mentioned, there, Richard, and I have to agree with you, is it focuses not only on the individual who's making decisions for themselves and perhaps a family, but, you know, just the idea as a society. And I thought it was a great reflection of the prompt. History, Stephen said, is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. So oftentimes generations pay for, you know, decisions made in the past. So excellent, right, and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. Boy, what a night. So with that, I am turning it back to you, Pam, for our next one. Where do you want to go next?
All right. Well, I have to ask, Richard, have you ever actually, like, attended, a Bloomsday festival or, like, a Bloomsday dinner?
You know, the funny thing is, as kind of, like, a solitary writer type of person, I've never actually done a big celebration. Also, admittedly, I am not much of a drinker. I'm kind of a lightweight, so. So I don't know that
right.
I'll last that long. Usually one beer and I'm out. So I'm a cheap guy.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I can. So, yeah, you'd have to – you could eat plenty of gizzards and kidneys and all that good stuff.
Yeah. I do like liver, so that I'll eat, like, especially if – done like the southern fried or Jewish chopped liver. I'll take either one.
Oh,
of those.
Yeah. Yep.
So,
my
you say liver.
Oh, what was that? I'm sorry.
Right?
I'm sorry. I was making a poor joke. Forget it.
Oh. Okay. I'm sorry, but. Yeah, no, it sounds good. My Jewish grandmother used to make creamed chicken livers and put them over rice.
Hmm, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, French pâté is a really exotic. I think some of them are amazing.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I see we got the next one, right? SoundCloud?
Yep.
Okay. All right. We'll all be able to rest our vocal cords, and I will pull it up. Here it goes.
What difference a day makes? Mirror, mirror on the wall. Handsome hunk, I stand so tall. Well-heeled rake with noble brows, strong jawline, underwrites bright sapphire eyeballs. His master's voice gramophone plays Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries. Sure-footed savant levitates before gilded gold mirror. Madame Tussauds installed wax copy a must. Such manly magnificence preserved from moth and rust. Narcissus, O Narcissus, kindly do desist. Dorian Gray simply couldn't resist. Mirror, mirror on the wall, mute and ornamental, best you fall. Spiderweb splinter each senseless shard. Must saber-tooth reality bite so hard? True reflection of who we are really is found within boomerang folks' reaction, we're fetter bound. Intuitive, sentient, loving-kind universe decrees, once upon a time we were one in primordial deep freeze. Bazooka, Big Bang, splintered snowballs, hope. Millennia marched us to mirror, mirror, grow. Cohesion sought in dualities, licorice, all sorts dance. Dandy, debonair fellow, gave me a vehemian glance. High voltage, irate reaction, repelled such pomp. A kind old lady's gay giggle, my ire did stump. Inner expletive, fricative mire mirrored by folks. Thy incongruent outer assonance, such a heavy yoke. Mirror, mirror on the wall, mute and ornamental, best you fall. What difference a day makes? 1,440 minutes, a bit and aid. 86,400 seconds for true reflection stay. Happy Blooms Day to all mirrors out there.
Thank you, Eric, for the SoundCloud. And Tim, if we can start with you, what do you think?
Yes, I always enjoy Eric Svensson's poetry and his SoundCloud. Such a wonderful reading voice. I like that he has it as a title and a line more than once, and, you know, what a difference a day makes. First of all, because, you know, as you know, the book Ulysses takes place on one day, June 16th. And then also because it's a song, and I wouldn't have known this except for you mentioned it earlier when we were commenting on Lauren's poem, is that Ulysses would oftentimes, you know, use songs within his writing. And so I think this works really well as a nod to Ulysses. I do also like that he throws in there, mirror, mirror on the wall, mute and ornamental, best you fall. Like, if all you're going to be good for is looking at, then perhaps you're not really any good at all. You know, I also like the bazooka, Big Bang, splintered snowball, hope, millennia marched us to mirror, mirror, grope, cohesion, thoughts and dualities, licorice, all sorts, dance. This has really fun imagery in it, but it also has the kind of metaphors that really make you think about how are we spending our time. I mean, you know, like 86,400 seconds sounds like a lot, but when you realize that's the seconds in one day, it passes by in a blink, you know, and so wonderful, thoughtful write, and very well done.
Absolutely, Pam. Great comment. Yeah, I caught that same stanza, mute and ornamental, best you fall, what a difference a day makes. And just bringing it all out there in the end, you know, that what is a day, which is really Joyce's question, how much occurs in a single day. And I thought, what a strong offering of philosophical musings on Indra's net of jewels, which is nowadays known as the Mandelbrot set, self-similarity, right? That we are all mirrors of each other. Yes, we're individuals. Yes, we have our own paths and we're different, but we all share that common humanity, all those similarities. We all need to be born and we need food, shelter, companionship. We will all end in the grave, so we are each other's mirrors, as Eric correctly points out. And then all of this is wrapped in Ulysses' June 16, 1904, Freeman's Journal newsprint. I thought it was some awesome poetry. Very well done. And Laurent, I will give you final word on this one.
Yeah, you may be sorry for that. okay, here we go. I was listening to some poetry online the other day, and I was listening to poems by T.S. Eliot. And this one particular one was read by Eliot. And I would have sworn that I was listening to Eric. And it was the similarity was startling, the way the lines were delivered. The accent just absolutely raised my eyebrows. Now, not all of Eliot's readings were in that tone of voice, but this one particular one was. I swear to God, if you heard it, you would think it was Eric Svensson. Now, perhaps it's a little unfair to bring up Eliot when they're talking about a Joyce poem, because they had two entirely different worldviews. Yet, Eric takes us very successfully through the entire idea of, a handsome person decaying, perhaps, the truth of mirrors, the way one has to look at the world. Mirror, mirror on the wall, mute and ornamental, best you fall. What difference a day makes? Then he breaks down a day and then wishes us happy Bloomsday to all mirrors out there, because we are, after all, reflections of ourselves. And the reflections that we see are of ourselves, whether we wish to deny it or not. True reflection of who we really are is found within Boomerang Folk's reaction. We're fetter bound. This is a great piece. You can say that about almost any of Eric's pieces, but I really like this one.
Absolutely. Great comment. And with that, Pam, I am turning it back to you.
All right. Up next, we have Portrait of the Artist as a Schizophrenic by Eric Daniel Herman. And Lauren, will you give that a read for us, please?
I might resemble this poem. You never know. Portrait of the Artist as a Schizophrenic. One. You knew me as Devo Triformis, Art Adonis, Apollo Dionysus, artisan of poetical lyrical music, picture of perfect hemispheric equilibrium, anima animus, mortal celestial, Taoist pendulum, and Buddhist median. Now here I stand with a multiplicity of personalities, fragments of the imagined and conjured, shaman with a schizophrenic rhetoric, mixture of invented mythic pseudonyms, animal, human, mania, melancholia, psychotic maze, and soporific days. The sunflowers speak in my tongue as my bee-kin buzz. Rhizomatic magic, unshackled from the dysphoric capitalistic chains and mace-chained flail whiplash, tearing my flesh apart of my inside face. In the orchid garden with the whispering wasps, my chest is warm as I play with my shadows in the pollen atmosphere of my space, of my safe space. Instead of the displaced hellscape, panopticon prison with blindingly bright, white, 10-foot mirror prism walls under shopping mall fluorescent lights, guarded by gray, brain-whispering, shape-shifting alien demons. 3. Barbie doll pink plastic flamingos stalk my daydreams, raping the silence of my private contemplation and sacred yogic meditation with the blood-curling, screeching rubber fall claws. I fly with owls and moonlit cloud waves in the nocturnal feasting ritual, not the Disney meets anime cartoon owl, but the predator with the blood, fur, and mouse meat hanging, dripping off her scalpel sharp talons. 4. My punctured mind, deflated of reality-scented air, inflated by hysterical phases of aberrant salience, as I drown under flash flood waves of dopamine, bursting my cranium seams, spilling me into hopscotch paranoia at the sound of a pin drop. I must stop this nanosecond, each key typed as we placed under further surveillance. I'm being watched by 33 cops and SWAT team as my laptop taps. Knots and crosses on the forehead wrinkles. My toes tap when I call it tic-tac-toe. The king is a jester. End poem.
Wonderful read, Laurent, and not an easy poem to read. Wow. I thought this was a tour de force glimpse into the schizophrenic mind of the artist, complete with gut-wrenching imagery and Joycean symbol. I thought it was hard to pick a single passage because the whole thing was just, you know, just a wonderful kaleidoscopic Joycean masterpiece. But I must stop this nanosecond. Each key type has me placed under further surveillance. I'm being watched by 33 cops and a SWAT team as my laptop safe. That was definitely a standout. And I, you know, I'm almost speechless. I thought it was really that good. And I have to say, to our credit, our prompts so far, I have noticed, have inspired 2 front page picks in less than 2 weeks' time. So not so bad. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, that's always a good feeling when you run a contest for a show and you get people get front page picks. This is absolutely stunning. Strong imagery and metaphors. I like how it goes, you know, back and forth between the light and the dark. And the light is always something almost gaudy, like the mention of the shopping mall fluorescent lights or the pink plastic flamingos and the Barbie dolls. There's such a sense of being taken in by the falseness of the world. And I also like where he mentions the owl, how it's not, you know, like the storybook owl, but the Disney meets anime cartoon owl, but the predator with blood, fur, and mouse meat hanging, dripping off her scalpel sharp talons. There's a real sense of the ugliness of dealing with schizophrenia or any mental disorder. Wonderful imagery. The sunflowers speak in my tongue as my beacon buzz. Rhythmic magic unshackles in the dysphoric capitalist chains. I like how that gives that idea of a sense of freedom from capitalism. Just a powerful and emotive write, and very well done.
Absolutely, Pam. And special thanks to Laurent for reading that poem and doing it justice, and for all of his efforts to make our pre-Bloomsday celebration so successful. And with that, I am turning it back to you, Pam, for our next piece.
All right. Yes, I have to say I very much appreciate Laurent and Mark both calling in. And I do hope that Neutron is feeling better soon.
Me too.
I was fortunate enough never to get it, but that COVID sucks from what I hear. So.
Yeah, yeah. What I've heard is that if you've had the two shots and the booster and you get it, it's kind of like a bad cold, but anything less than that can be devastating. And even with that caveat, some people just get hit really hard with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Up next, we have I Am a Genius by Poetic Picasso, and it goes like this. If one were to live his life fully and were to give form to every feeling, expression to every thought, reality to every dream, he would be a genius. There are many men who pretend to know all the secrets of life, who have no charm, wit, nor personality. The true critic bears within himself the dreams and ideas of generations, and to whom no form of thought is alien, no emotional impulse obscure. Anybody can make history. Only a great man can write it and express it so eloquently and passionately. It is a terrible thing for a man to find out suddenly that all his life he has been speaking nothing but the truth. Society exists only as a mental concept. In the real world, there are only enslaved individuals and dreamers. Most people are too boring and naive to understand the difference between dreams and aspirations. Vulgarity is the conduct of other people just as falsehoods are the truths of other people that remain emboldened critics. The more one analyzes people, the more all reason for analysis disappears so abruptly. I am the only person in the world I should like to know thoroughly and expect to be civil. A genius learns from nature, its own nature. Talent learns from art. Thus, a genius is a natural artist. The manner of an artist is essentially individual. The method of an artist is absolutely universal in its composition. For an artist is his first critic, but none of the envy of men, they fancy themselves wise and knowledgeable. These are men of art that are invidious, and there are men of art that are uniquely each a brilliant genius. Like it or not, I am a genius. End poem.
Great, Pam. Yeah, and that was inspired by prompt two. A man of genius makes no mistakes. His errors are volitional and are the portals of discovery. And I love that quote. I love that prompt. One of my favorites. And I thought he did a good job picking this poem as a riffing off of that prompt. The philosophical poem questions a man of genius in a manner that I imagine Joyce himself would have loved, and was in many ways reminiscent of the Ithaca episode of Ulysses. And I especially liked society exists only as a mental concept. In the real world, there are only enslaved individuals and dreamers. Most people are too boring and naive to understand the difference between dreams and aspirations. It's a great poem, really quite appropriate for a night where we celebrate Joyce, who definitely had the self-awareness and the self-confidence to proclaim himself an artist very early on in his career. And what do you think of the piece, Pam?
You know, I enjoyed this. There are times when somebody picks a pre-write and puts it on a topic board, and it works so well for this topic. And the first thing I liked about this is, as I was reading it, when I was looking at it earlier today, I imagined Ulysses and Oscar Wilde sitting on a park bench together, feeding pigeons and having a conversation. And I liked that thought, and I liked that this poem brought that thought to my mind. I like that Poetic Picasso, Frank does the Oscar Wilde pieces so well. And as you mentioned, this is a reflection of society and how oftentimes those who think they're wise are simply nothing more than you know, ignorant. I like that line, society exists only as a mental concept. And I think, I think Joyce would have fun delving into that. So, you know, excellent write and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. Okay, and with that, I think we're ready to move on to our next one.
All right. Let's see. All right. Here we go. All right. Having the next one, and up next we have Ulysses by Lawrence 67. And Richard, your turn now.
Okay. I know it becomes more conversational when it's just the two of us. Neutron and I had that same experience. It's pretty cool.
Okay.
So
do you want me to read one of the parts?
No. I didn't mean it that way. No, I meant that it's more like like you and I now on the radio are having this conversation.
Oh, yes.
Going back and forth, right? So, okay, so this one is Lawrence 67. It's called Ulysses, and it goes like this. The Adventures of Nigel, the Fat Cat, and his homie, Alfie, in Ulysses. Hey, Nigel, what you doing? Hey, Alfie, I'm a-reading this here son of a biscuit, motherfucker, up your pie hole, expletive deleted, your ass's kisses Ulysses. Allie, huh? Nigel, that's not like you cussing so much. You better watch it or they'll ban you from this contest. Nigel. No, Alfie, this is about James Joyce. Alfie, well, which is it, Mr. or Mrs.? Nigel. Alfie, you don't understand. It's both. Alfie, oh, a transcendental? Nigel, no, dumbass. His name is James Joyce. Alfie, oh, I get it now. Nigel, you do? Good. Alfie, yeah, I get that you're the dumbass, and I am going to snitch on you for cussing so much. Hey, L67, Nigel is cussing at transcendental people, and he calls you a dumbass. Nigel, freaking asshole, I'm going to kick your ass. Alfie, come here so I can stick my paw up your booty. Alfie, help. Nigel, don't you run from me, you son of an expletive deleted booger eater. Alfie, help. And end poem. That was fun.
Oh,
so,
it really was.
Yeah, so funny thing was that I forgot that this was a dialogue, and it just so happened that Laurent just recently dropped, and I remembered this from 2 weeks ago when at a certain point it was just Neutron and I, and we ended up kind of like just having a conversation. So I get what you were saying now, or what you were asking. But on to the poem. Let's talk about it. So I thought that he caught much of Joyce's humor, wordplay, stream of consciousness vibe. Plus, he named Leopold and Molly's nameless puss. So in the Calypso episode, Leopold and Molly Bloom have a cat. It's not named. Then, you know, it's just called Puss. He's like, here, Puss. Does the Puss want the food? Or whatever he says. I forget the exact line. And here he names the nameless cat from Ulysses. So very clever. The whole thing is really great. Again, I don't know how the hell I'm going to judge this contest. It's just every one of these is gold. And what do you think of it, Pam?
Well, you know, I have to say, I do enjoy and appreciate Lawrence 67's sense of humor. I do like his Nigel and Alfie skits that he does. Nigel and Alfie are actually, I don't know if you know this, but they're actually the names of his cats, his real life. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Very cool.
Yes, but yeah, I like how he especially goes into the misunderstanding with Joyce's name, you know, like, because we oftentimes call him Joyce, it is a feminine name. You know, to me, comedy of confusion is some of the funniest comedy that is out there. You know, I just really absolutely enjoyed this, and I thought it was very well done.
Absolutely. Yeah, great. Where do you want to go now?
All right. Up next, we have Love's Lament by Kingsley Medland, and it goes like this. Shut your eyes and see a world that was and still ought to be. We walk a different path, you and me. Each day now seems ever longer, nothing but war, plague, despair, and misery. Surely this isn't the way that it's meant to be. World gone wrong. The clock is ticking. The days are really getting shorter. Come the end, the world will give each of us no quarter. The forests are burning, and we've poisoned the water. We, all of us, must find a different way before an everlasting night follows the last day. So whilst there's still the time to dream, walk that path with me. Cherish the things we've done and seen. Lay your sweetheart down beside me. Simply shut your eyes and see. End poem.
Nicely read, Pam. Yeah, I liked where the poet went with the prompt, bending it to our current collective existential dilemma by shutting our eyes. The dazzling display, which Shakespeare called the sound and fury, is quieted, and we can focus on preserving our Mother Earth before it's too late. So I thought it was a wonderful take on the prompt and nicely done, good execution of the message, which is an important one. It's the only planet we got, as far as I know. What do you think? And what do you think of it, Pam?
Oh, I really enjoyed this. It was beautiful and thoughtful. You know, it really just makes us realize, you know, that the world is falling apart and we need to do something to make it beautiful. You know, but I like This one is kind of opposite of the one from the same prompt earlier. The one from the same prompt is the idea of closing your eyes to see the good around you. And this one is like closing your eyes to see all that is going on in the world that is, you know, ugly and brutal. Just a really strong write and very well done.
Yeah, that's a really good insight too, you know, how two poets can take the same prompt and go in exactly the opposite direction with each other. Pretty amazing.
It truly is. Yes,
yeah.
The Mackintosh Man by Keith Palethorpe. And your turn there, Richard.
Yep. Okay. So let me get it. Here it is. Right. This is another just great one. The Mackintosh Man by Keith Palethorpe. Reports of his existence were greatly exaggerated. His comings and goings were generally unremarkable and unremarked. His motives were at most moot. His origin cloaked in the mists of mystery. But his existential bareness was a priori, though his post hoc factness was equivocal. Yet who are we to say him nay? Nay, I say, lackaday. And may the better man better himself at the expense of the lesser in the time-honored tradition of our tribe. And let the leaser keep a firm grip on the leash of the lessee, lest I digress, and in so doing, abridge too far. For Mackintosh, thou seldom wert. End poem. What a fun piece that was. So wordplay galore, lots of tongue-twisting alliteration, and just very clever. I did read this beforehand, and I was much more wide awake when I did so, so I kind of fumbled a little bit on some of the wordplay, but I love the theme, and I love that he tackled the man in the Mackintosh, because Joyce loved putting these mysteries into his book to drive scholars and readers nuts, and I've heard many theories of this man in the Mackintosh, including one that the man in the Mackintosh is actually James Joyce. But of course, the mystery is intentionally unsolvable. And that, in fact, is the point of this mystery, that we can never know who the man in the Mackintosh is. And I'm really happy to see that he tackled the man in the Mac. Great. Always nice to ponder the mysteries of James Joyce. And Pam, what'd you think of it?
Yeah, this is great. I'm so glad that you commented first and mentioned the mystery of the Mackintosh Man. And I'm looking at the AN and I see the line where it says, "And the banker in Penny Lane never wore a Mac in the pouring rain, very strange and probably irrelevant." That's funny in itself. But yeah, there's great wordplay. Though his post hoc factness was equivocal. Yet who are we to say him nay? Nay, I say, lackaday. I love the use of the word lackaday. And, you know, it's fun, it's clever, it's playful. And, of course, Penny Lane makes me think of the Beatles song, which I'm sure that's what it was supposed to make me think of. So excellent write and very well done.
Yeah, and the nice thing about this poem was that even though prior to reading it, you didn't necessarily know about the whole Mackintosh thing in the Hades episode, it still worked for you, and you still were able to enjoy it.
Absolutely.
I think that's really, and I think that's really the mark of a good poem, is even if you don't get all the layers, it's still an enjoyable read, and so quite an accomplishment. Another brilliant piece. Okay,
yep.
Where do you want to go?
All right. Up next we have Stephen's Day or Stephen's Day by Anton mm-hmm. Amsford, 37. And it goes like this. I slithered out that shiny silver day, my heart afire with anger, lust, and pity at those whose dreams are so puny. I saw the shabby souls spit out the half-boiled remnants of a night of sullen debauchery. If I were Michelangelo, I would flay myself and paint their chambers of hell, but hell is too full of pandering prelates and bullying bishops. I feel so aimed here of hope and purpose. Should I be like Kafka and try to go to America, abandon this rotting continent? My crystal ball tells me no, stop. Who is this? End poem.
Wonderfully read there, Pam. Okay, so here's what's going on. At the end of the Ithaca episode, we have, so there's three main characters in Ulysses. There's Stephen Dedalus, there's Leopold Bloom, and there's his wife, Molly Bloom. And the end of Ithaca is the last we see of Stephen in the novel. The brilliance of Anton Amsford 37's poetry is he takes us on Stephen's journey after he leaves Bloom's house and continues on. So quite an ambitious endeavor. And I saw the shabby souls spit out half-boiled remnants, a night of sullen debauchery, which is, you know, this is what happens as he's walking home after he leaves Bloom's house. And I wrote, I could be wrong, of course, but this stanza in particular led me to think that we're following Stephen Dedalus after the end of the Ithaca episode, after he leaves 7 Eckley Street, Bloom's house, and we follow his glorious musings, indeed following hinting of Dante's Inferno and even of Joyce's jealousy of Kafka. I thought it was just a brilliant idea and so well executed. That one was just like jaw-droppingly good. And what do you think of it, Pam?
This was another one I enjoyed. This has been such a great night of poetry. I always like Anton's writing. And I didn't know, of course, obviously, that Stephen was a character, but, you know, this kind of made me think of St. Stephen, the Apostle Stephen from the Bible, and how he was the first martyr in the Bible. I really liked, if I were Michelangelo, I would lay myself and paint their chambers of hell, but hell is too full of pandering prelates and bullying bishops. Such wonderful lines on hypocrisy. And I liked how there's a dark humor in, you know, the mention of Kafka and my crystal ball tells me no stop. You know, the idea of how much we depend on objects throughout history to give us directions. And so mm-hmm. excellent writing, very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment, Pam. We are running out of time, but I want to thank you so much for stepping in and helping out when Neutron got sick. Thanks to Laurent. Thanks to Mark. Special thanks, as always, to Fill My Eyes for being our group admin. And please join us in a half an hour when Pam will bring you her After Midnight show. So thanks again, Pam. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Great show. Good night.
Night.